So I'll just start by saying this is work that I did with Joe and has significant overlap with some work that Shamit Kakru, Mike Schultz, and Simon Trivedi did at about the same time. So I'd like to start today just by giving you a little bit of the motivation about why we were looking at this, discuss in some detail what the background supergravity solution is, including a few of the details, talk about the low energy effective theory in four dimensions, and check that the moduli space is the correct form, and then discuss, partially at least, our understanding of the BPS states and the U-duality group, which is not quite complete at this point in time. But anyway, and then I'll wrap it up by talking about some directions I'm hoping to go in the future. Okay. So why were Joe and I doing this? Essentially, warp compactifications in general have become very interesting over the last few years because they provide a framework for rephrasing the hierarchy problem. Instead of it being a sort of renormalization scale, perhaps you can think of it in terms of the size of compact extra dimensions. And you know, we're not really going to address the issue of why those extra dimensions are the size they are. But hopefully, we can increase the understanding of how warp compactifications work within string theory, and that a lot of the warp compactifications that have been studied have been sort of toy models. So we wanted to get at what the string theory looks like. And the 10-dimensional form of the metric that we're going to be looking at in terms of warped compactifications is of a generalized D3 brain type with the same warp factor, just inverted on the compact and non-compact directions. Okay. We wanted to look at backgrounds with high supersymmetry because that puts constraints on the moduli space and the dynamics, despite the fact that these backgrounds are highly non-perturbative in terms of the string coupling. For example, it was shown that in a paper by Giddings, Kakru, and Polchinski last year that there's a self-duality condition on the free-form flux in the extra dimensions. And this implies that the string coupling is order unity, or thereabouts. Okay. And you can't really quantize strings and fluxes very well, but particularly the string coupling. It's a highly non-perturbative effect, again, but with the high supersymmetry, we can hope to study it even in small radii limit. Okay. However, we don't want to just look at the usual n equals 4 compactification with O3 planes and 16 D3 brains in the type 2 context that's directly dual to heterotic theory on a T6. It's well studied, and you don't see how the warping and fluxes can fix moduli or break supersymmetry and gauge symmetries in the bulk theory. So that's one reason we wanted to turn on the fluxes and break down to n equals 3. And finally, we just thought, you know, n equals 3 supergravity is kind of exotic. There are maybe 3 or 4 other papers on it previously in the literature. So we thought it would be kind of fun to look at it. And you should note, it's important to remember that in terms of supergravity, n equals 3 is not the same as n equals 4, even though it is in the global supersymmetry limit. And you can just check that by looking at the gravitational multiplets in both cases. And I'll actually have that written up later on in the talk. So let me start by reviewing what the background solution looks like. First of all, it's in a class of exact supergravity solutions that generalize the standard D3 brain solution of 10-dimensional supergravity. And the most important characteristic of it is G. Here's a complex combination of the Ramon-Ramond and NS-NS three-form fluxes satisfies this imaginary self-duality condition on the internal manifold or internal space. And here are a list of papers that talked about this class of solutions. Becker and Becker introduced it in the M-theory context, and then these two papers talked about it in type 2b. Okay. One thing that was noticed in the non-compact case by Klebnov and Strassler in their cascading string field theory correspondence is that the three-form, the self-dual three-form, acts as if it replaces D3 brains. Essentially, we'll see that this is a source for the five-form flux, just as a D3 brain would. And also, again, compactifying this setup, which is has a conifold singularity, gives you a way to see a finite hierarchy between the gauge and gravitational scales, which is determined by the quantized fluxes on cycles in the compact manifold. And that generally will freeze many moduli. They're able to show that all but one could be frozen classically and possibly all quantum mechanically. We wanted to look at something with more supersymmetry because it's a little bit easier to see what's going on and get to all the physics. Okay. So I just want to get in a little bit more detail and show you how we can find an n equals 3 case. We're going to take complex coordinates like so, and only choose one component of the three-form flux, the O3 component, to turn on. Now, for supersymmetry, the supersymmetry variation should be a six-dimensional spinner with negative chirality on the six-dimensional internal space. And the flux should satisfy these conditions. Okay. Now, a negative chirality spinner is one such that all the anti-holomorphic gamma matrices annihilate it, or one that's raised twice by the holomorphic gamma matrices. And there are three of these spinners, and these actually, if you just plug them in, satisfy all the constraints. So there's three different six-dimensional spinners corresponding to three different full supersymmetries. Okay. And I just want to say that this isn't actually, again, the first appearance of n equals 3 supergravity. Castiani et al. In the 80s constructed the supergravity as a field theory. Farrar and Kunis in 89 gave a construction of it along with other extended supersymmetries in string theory using a free fermion construction on the world sheet. And the BPS states of n equals 3 string compactifications were studied by Kunis and Kumar in 97. Some of you might be a little bit more familiar with another way of looking at the supersymmetry counting. Usually one talks about having the three-form flux is a 2-1 form in given complex coordinates and primitive with respect to the metric. So if you contract it with the metric, it vanishes. Essentially, there are three complex sets of coordinates that you can choose that G is 2-1 and primitive. So you can have your Z's just turn two of the W's into their complex conjugates. And Again, there's three patterns that you can do that in.
Jig hat annihilates only gamma I, gamma j, chi, but do not annihilate chi.
Say it, what was it?
It's only gamma ij kind of issues per se, and chi naught is not.
That's right. Chi naught does not satisfy these. So the gamma ij chi naught does, but it does for any ij. And the chi naught is just a base spinner to define how we're taking the negative chirality, essentially. But that's correct. This is not a supersymmetry with the fluxes turned on. In the case of only D3 brains and no fluxes, this would also be supersymmetry.
Okay.
So this is a supersymmetry that's broken by the fact that we've got three form fluxes. All right, and just list the form of the background solution that we'll be using. Again, the form of the metric. G-twiddle is a flat, Ricci flat metric on the internal space. We'll be choosing a six torus. And again, just flat background, flat space-time. The three form fluxes will be constant and will satisfy the imaginary self-duality condition. The dilaton and axion we can take to be constant by the equations of motion. And again, they're fixed by the fluxes. And the dilaton is usually fixed so that the string coupling is order unity. The five-form flux is just given by the warp factor. And one chunk of it is proportional to the volume form on the space-time. The actual warp factor is determined equally well by the Einstein equation or the Bianchi identity for the phi form, which give you the same equation here. And so this is in terms of the G tilde metric. And you can solve this equation in our setup by using the method of images. Okay, and that's discussed in a paper by Green, Shalman, Chu. Now you'll notice that the contribution to the warp factor from the three form is necessarily positive. Whereas if you integrate this over the entire internal manifold, it's the total derivative that's going to vanish. So there has to be some localized source with negative D3 brain charge. And to do that, we're going to require orientifold three planes. So again, the simplest way we can set this up is a T6 with a Z2 orientifold, just as usual. So again, the setup is very much as if you took the type 1 theory on a T6 and T-dualized on the entire internal space and then added fluxes to it. Wanted to talk a little bit about the flux quantization on the torus and how this affects the orientifold planes, since this was something that came up as an interesting issue. The boundary conditions at the orientifold planes you can determine either by considering T-duality from the type 1 theory, where you know what the world sheet parity action is on the different fields, or you can work with it directly in the type 2B case using world sheet parity and the space-time reflection and world sheet fermion number. But essentially, the internal and space-time metrics are OK. The vectors from the two forms are OK. And these particular components of the four-form potential is fine. The odd fields we're essentially going to ignore because of their boundary conditions. They're Kaluza-Klein modes. And we'll see in a second that we can take them to be massive in comparison. OK. Flux quantization, you would think would be pretty straightforward. And it is on most of the T6. But there are special half-size three cycles. So for example, if you take three of the coordinates to be vanishing, say x, I don't know, 4, 5, and 6, then on the x 7, 8, 9 three cycle is going to map to itself under the orientation projection. So it's essentially half size. And so you'd think that the usual quantization condition would not allow odd integer fluxes with appropriate normalization. And it turns out, you can just think about this by considering a point particle on a two torus with a Z2 identification. Odd fluxes, odd magnetic fluxes, can be compensated by flux that's stuck at one of the fixed points. So for example, you just set up your gauge field, you choose a gauge, and realize there are gauge transformations for the charged particle as you do the 2 pi translations around the torus. And if you compare that with what happens when you do the reflection, you find that at one of the fixed points, circling one of those fixed points gives you a phase for the particle, which you can interpret as saying that fixed point has half a Dirac unit of flux. Okay. And the same thing is true in the case of strings on a T3 by Z2. And in fact, it's been known for quite a while that some orientifold three planes have a unit of flux stuck in them, either NSNS or RR. Or both. This is known as discrete torsion. It's been studied in the context of K-theory. As far as I know, the first instance that these were run across was in a paper by Witten regarding the ADS-CFT correspondence. And these O3 planes that do have the discrete torsion also have an extra plus a half D3 brain charge. So the usual orientifold three planes have negative 1/4. These have positive 1/4. And in this case, the integrated Bianchi identity becomes this equation. N is the number of free D3 brains. N tilde is the number of these orientifold three planes with discrete torsion. And this is the contribution to the D3 brain charge from the three-form fluxes. And that's, again, got to add up to the usual 16 D3 brains for the type 1 case. Just give some examples. You can, again, if you turn on the H and F three-form fluxes on these cycles, that satisfies the self-duality condition. If you also have other constraints on the metric or the size of the compact dimensions and the complex dilaton axion. Okay, so those are fixed in terms of the three forms if you require the imaginary self-duality. Okay. And again, just some examples that you have. If you have non-zero fluxes H1 and F2 set to 2 each, you have 8 D3 brains free and unit dilaton. The other's pretty straightforward how you would get here. You can see that you have uneven fluxes, you have non-unit dilaton. And if you have any odd fluxes, then you need to introduce orientifold planes with discrete torsion. So before I move on to discussion of the low energy theory. Are there any more questions? No? No. Okay. Well, we could look at the low energy effective theory just by studying the equations of motion. This isn't so much discussed in the paper that we had out, but will be in somewhat more detail in the future. But just by looking at the equations of motion directly, you can check that the mass squared for fields that are stabilized by the fluxes is of the order g squared, which is the string mass squared times alpha prime over r squared cubed. So in a large radius limit, the fields that are stabilized by the fluxes acquire a small mass. And again, this gives us a hierarchy in the large radius limit. There are some massless fields. There are fields that are stabilized or given mass by the fluxes. Then the Kaluza-Klein modes are two powers larger. And so we can just cut off or truncate the theory here and study only the stabilized and massless modes together as an effective theory. And there's string excitations and winding modes also. Okay. Just sort of as an aside, I wanted to mention a couple of technicalities that come up if you do try to look at the equations of motion. One is that the background fluxes give gauge transformations to, in order to choose potentials that give constant background fluxes, the potentials are non-periodic. They're only periodic up to a gauge transformation. And this is okay for, it turns out, the vectors that descend from the two-form potentials, but is not simple. It's not a simple transformation for the four-form potential, which is a massless field. So we need to do a field redefinition to find fluctuations that are periodic as you go around the torus. Okay. So that was just one technicality. Another one is that the massless fields don't actually need to be Kaluza-Klein zero modes. So what I'm calling Kaluza-Klein modes here is, in a generalized sense, some modes with non-trivial dependence on the internal directions are massless. And it's been well studied that the four-dimensional graviton depends on the warp factor the same way that the four-dimensional metric does. And it's the same story with the internal metric fluctuations. Actually, the most complicated case is that of the field strength that corresponds to unbroken gauge symmetries. And turns out if it satisfies one self-duality condition, it is a true Kaluza-Klein zero mode with no dependence on the internal coordinates. If it has the opposite chirality, essentially, then there is a massless solution, but it's has a complicated dependence on the internal coordinates, which, as far as I know, no one's worked out yet. So, you know, again, this is something that might be useful to look at in the future. And the chirality of the G-flux comes in because it couples to the five-form, which again has a piece proportional to the volume form in four dimensions. Okay. I wanted to discuss the pattern of supersymmetry breaking. Again, before you turn on fluxes, the low energy effective theory looks like n equals 4 supergravity. And the gravity multiplet is the standard n equals 4 supergravity multiplet. It looks like that. In particular, 4 gravitini and 6 vectors in the gravitational multiplet. And additionally, in the string theory, there are 6 vector multiplets. So 12 total U1 in the bulk. There's also 16 D3 brains. Now, if you turn on the fluxes, this breaks you down to n equals 3, as we've seen just from supersymmetry counting. And that means you can only have 3 gravitinos and 3 vectors in the gravitational multiplet. And in fact, you find out that there are only 3 other bulk vector multiplets that are not Higgs. And so there has to be another massive supermultiplet. And this is a massive spin 3/2 multiplet. And if you just compare the states, if you take these massless multiplets and add in these massive states, then you would get precisely this n equals 4 multiplet content. So it really looks like the spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. And again, we can see that the supersymmetry breaking is spontaneous because the mass scale of this, again, is parametrically below all other mass scales, including the Planck scale. Okay, and the supersymmetry breaking, if you see a number of vectors get massive, is connected with gauge symmetry breaking. So it's just nice to see that the Higgs effect works as usual in this case. And we can look at it in a couple different ways. But one, the easiest thing to do is to take a complex combination of the RR and NS two form that descend to vectors. This is the same combination you have combining the three-form fluxes into the G-flux. And this has a usual gauge transformation like any muon vector would in 4 dimensions. But in addition to this, the C4 potential gets shifted by this one form. And the condition for the symmetries to be left unbroken is that the background is unchanged by that gauge transformation. So we can see that since G is an O3 form, then if lambda bar is O1, then this would give you a 0 shift. And similarly, G bar is 3O. If lambda is 1O, then again, there's not any shift of the background 4 form. So the 1O parts of the gauge transformation leave the background fixed, the holomorphic vectors are unbroken, and the anti-holomorphic ones acquire mass. Okay. And just by looking at this transformation of the C4, you can see that some of them, since they are shifted by the gauge transformations of these broken gauge symmetries, they're going to be the Goldstone bosons. Okay. Now, if we just look at what the perturbative 5-form flux looks like, it's got this 4-form potential and mixing with the vectors, specifically the massive ones. And if you were to look at the vector equation of motion, this couples in just like a mass term would for that appropriate vector. And it also gives you the gauge covariant derivative of the 3-1 and 1-3 4-form potentials. Okay. So again, these are the Goldstone bosons. Okay. So what we have left are 6 real gauge fields, or 3 complex ones left, plus 1 additional real gauge field for each D3 brain that's left in the background. And of these six gauge fields, three of them are in the gravity multiplet. We can figure out what the moduli are by sort of similar type of considerations. So if you just look at self-duality of the three form, the metric has to be Hermitian. The reason is, if you have a non-Hermitian part, then you're going to have components of the Levi-Civita tensor that don't take O3 to O3. And that would violate the self-duality condition. So these are the complex moduli of the torus. Those are frozen. And the Kähler moduli, or the deformations of the Hermitian part of the metric, are still flat directions. So in particular, you can take this to be any size that you want. And again, it's a no-scale model, just as Giddings, Kacker, and Bolchinski found in more general cases. Okay, there are also, the Ramon-Ramon 4 form has the equivalent of Wilson lines around the four cycles of the torus. And some of these are not gauged away. As you remember, only the 3-1 and 1-3 parts were Goldstone bosons. So the 2-2 parts are actually physical degrees of freedom. And these are also moduli. Okay. And there's nothing to fix the positions of the D3 brains on the internal space. So those are also moduli. And those are most conveniently written in complex form. Okay. The total number of real moduli that you have 9 real components of the metric from GI J-bar. And there are 9 real components of the 2-2 part of the 4 form. And there's 6n D3 brain positions. And you find that you have 6 moduli for each one of the n plus 3 vector multiplets. And that's exactly the right counting for n equals 3 or n equals 4. That's good to know. Now, from previous work on n equals 3 supergravity, we knew that the moduli space should have locally this coset form, U3, 3 plus n by U3 times U3 plus n. And we wanted to check that that comes through just by looking at our warp compactification without just waving our hands and saying it must be so. And we ran into a couple of interesting issues going through like this. First of all, if you just do dimensional reduction naively, we get terms that look like what we call multi-trace terms. So you'd expect the moduli to be written as a matrix of fields that fits into this coset form. And the kinetic term to be a trace of del m, del m. But we find that, again, you've got derivatives of the determinant of the metric, which would look like trace times trace. And that just doesn't fit into this coset form. So the solution to this, to get rid of these funny terms, is to rescale the moduli by the determinant of the metric. Okay. And similarly, the Ramon-Ramon moduli can be turned into a two index form like so. And then we can assemble these things into the correct coset that we want. One thing to note is that the D3 brains are magnetic sources. So the 5-form fluctuations that give you the kinetic term for these Ramon-Ramon moduli is not just purely, it's got some non-potential terms. And these terms here correspond to Chern-Simons terms of the 10-dimensional type 1 or heterotic supergravity. So it's nice to see that the same terms are showing up in a different physical context, but they're necessary for the duality group and the coset form of the moduli space. And once again, we do get the appropriate coset form, and we could check all of that. Now, as I've mentioned a couple of times before, the background that we have is just taking the n equals 4 supergravity and getting spontaneous supersymmetry and symmetry breaking. So we should be able to see how our moduli correspond to the moduli of the heterotic theory. And so first you can take an s-duality from heterotic to type 1, and then a t-duality in all six internal directions down to the type 2b case that we've got. And indeed, we find that the space-time metric in the heterotic theory corresponds precisely to the Einstein metric of the 2b theory in four dimensions. The internal metric goes over to precisely what we had defined as the gamma modulus, and the same thing, the NS2 form corresponds to the appropriate combination of four forms. And the Wilson lines just go over to the D3 brain positions. There are some additional factors of two, which Joe and I have been chasing down. But up to factors, this is exactly what we got by just naively going through doing the dimensional reduction and saying, what do we need to put in to get the appropriate coset form for the moduli space? So it's, again, nice to see this. It's a good check, basically. Now that we know the low energy theory, we can go ahead and think about what the BPS states are and the duality group of the theory. And it's best to start with the n equals 4 case because, again, that's well understood in the heterotic dual. So we can compare the heterotic form to the type 2b form. So we know in the heterotic theory, shifts of Wilson lines are dualities. And that just corresponds to shifting the D3 brain coordinates around a circle on the torus. Now, actually, it's not quite the same. Here, shifting the Wilson line corresponds to, if I can get it right, shifting the winding number of fundamental strings in the heterotic theory. Here, shifting the D3 brain coordinates, it's more obvious to see that it shifts the, again, the F string winding number, which corresponds to the Kaluza-Klein momentum in the heterotic theory. So the obvious dualities from the perspective of BPS charges is different. On the heterotic side, there's the vial group, which corresponds to permutations of the D3 brains. There are shifts of the two form, which correspond to shifts of the appropriate modulus. And there's what we're calling R duality, or the usual inversion of radius T duality, calling it R to distinguish it from this, the full T duality. And the manifestation of this in the type 2b theory is not really clear. There's no obvious way to see what it does unless you just say, well, the moduli do this and that. The reason is this. If you consider the BPS states exchanged by this R-duality, in the heterotic theory, the Kaluza-Klein momentum gets changed to winding F string number. Whereas if you follow the S and T dualities to type 2B theory, that's an F string that's winding around the torus getting exchanged with a D5 brain that winds around the torus. And similarly for the magnetic charges, it would be an NS5 brain being exchanged with a winding D string. And the five brains have to be wrapped on a sort of half volume T5. So, you know, it's not really obvious exactly what the duality would be that would do this. We know it exists. And it turns out if you check the masses of, you know, the F string and the D5 brain, and you can write those in terms of the heterotic string radius, and under inversion of that radius, then you find that the masses of the F string and D5 brain precisely interchange. And the same thing for the NS5 and D string. Okay? So, you know, we can tell you what the dualities do now, essentially, in the type 2B theory. But once again, the dualities that are most obviously manifest in the heterotic theory are not in type 2B, and a little bit vice versa. Okay. So now we can actually get on to the N equals 3 theory and look at what the electric and magnetic BPS states are. Well, if we just take an example, tau equals I, the unbroken vectors are C4 minus B7, B4 plus C7, and so on the other T2 factors. So the electric states, for example, of this vector are a D4 brain winding once and a D string winding once in the 4 direction, an F string winding negative once in the 7 direction, or F string in the 4 direction and a D string in the 7 direction. But we should note that these also couple to broken gauge fields. So this state would couple to C4 plus B7 also. And that doesn't really have an effect on the electric charges, but Tuft made an argument that magnetic charges of broken gauge field should be confined. And so the D5 and NS5 brain states that we had in the N equals 4 case don't really exist separately in the N equals 3 theory. An alternate way that we can see this is that if you just look at the D5, there's a world volume flux that satisfies this Bianchi identity. Now, this is inconsistent in our background because there's at least one 3 cycle on the D5 brain with a non-vanishing H. And so you integrate this side and get 0, and integrate this side and get something non-zero. So you've got to have some source that for this world volume flux that cancels out the NS field strength. Now, fortunately, so if you consider this vector here, it'd be a D5 brain wrapped in every direction except the 4 direction. The corresponding NS5 brain, which is wrapped in any direction except the 7 direction, carries precisely the opposite broken magnetic charge. So you can form a bound state of D5 and NS5 brains, which are perpendicular to each other, and those will carry no net magnetic charge for the broken U1 symmetry. So it seems like we do have magnetic states still. It does lead to a question of what's the state counting. It seems like we've got two independent electric states, either a D string or an F string for this vector, but only one magnetic state, the bound state of the NS5 and D5 brains. So the question becomes then, how many states are there really for each of the strings? Perhaps the D string and F string don't each give you a full supermultiplet. Maybe they only give you half of a supermultiplet. This isn't determined yet, and it's actually a question that I'm pursuing with Mariana currently. Another thing that's nice to know is you can check whether these states preserve supersymmetry in common with the background. And they do preserve four supersymmetries each. And this is expected. Kunis and Kumar discussed and showed that with the n equals 3 superalgebra, any BPS particle state is 1/3 BPS, has four supercharges. Okay. So again, it's a nice check. Now, there are also BPS instantons. And these would be Euclidean D3 brains, so they're wrapped in four directions around the internal torus, that couple to the 4-4 moduli, which are actually axions if you look at the action. But they don't, you know, these instantons don't actually appear to correspond to an enhanced symmetry. Let me elaborate on that comment a little. We only have abelian gauge symmetries at a generic point in our moduli space. And as far as we know, there's no way to get an enhanced symmetry involving the bulk gauge vectors. So, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to talk about instantons, except perhaps that these are the zero size limit of instantons that appeared in the n equals 4 theory, where from a discussion of the heterotic enhanced symmetry group, we do know that the bulk gauge vectors can be involved in enhanced symmetries. So again, we've got these zero size instantons that appear to be left over from the n equals 4 case and breaking of enhanced symmetries. Now, there are two types of these instantons. One that corresponds to the diagonal axions, and another type that corresponds to the off-diagonal axions. The diagonal ones, oddly enough, preserve six supersymmetries in common with the background, which is okay because instantons break Lorentz invariants. And the off-diagonal ones preserve four supersymmetries, just like the electric and magnetic charges did. And they come in bound state pairs, just like the NS and D5 brains. And I should mention, just by looking at the corresponding states in the type 1 theory and looking at Chan-Patton factors, we know that these instantons wrap, again, special half-volume 4 cycles. Okay. Now, the axion beta has, as usual, a classical shift symmetry, and the instantons break that to a discrete group, as usual. And there are magnetic charges that for the axion, which are space-time strings, and those are D3 brains that are wrapped on a 2 torus and extended in one direction in space-time. And the axion has a monodromy around the string, and that agrees with the minimum shift of the axion. So you go around the string, and to get back to where you started with, you have to perform one of the dualities. Okay. There's an additional shift duality that we mentioned before. The D3 brain shifting around the torus shifts the bulk charges both by the electric charge of the world volume vectors and the magnetic charge. So an F string is an electric charge on the D3 brains. That shifts the electric charge of the bulk vectors. A D string is a magnetic charge on the D3 brains, but we saw the D strings are electric charges in the bulk. So this is actually an electric-magnetic duality of a type, even though it's would in the heterodic case be an electric-electric duality. There are some more geometric type dualities or large coordinate transformations. For them to be true u-dualities, they need to fix the background. So we're looking for large coordinate transformations that leave the three-form flux invariant. And that's fine if they have unit determinant. But we need to restrict them to those that don't permute the O3 planes of different type. So, you know, again, we're just looking for the dualities of the larger n equals 4 theory that leave the n equals 3 background fixed. And I should mention, all these transformations have to be unitary to preserve the hermeticity of the metric. Okay. Now, for some specific backgrounds, there are other rotations that, when you combine them with the usual SL2Z duality of the type 2 B string, you actually do end up getting, you know, something that preserves the background. So specifically, if you have the string coupling equal to 1 and no Ramon scalar, then a pi rotation, or a, sorry, a pi halves rotation on one of the square 2 tori multiplies the 3 form by a factor of I, but the usual string coupling inversion duality multiplies it by a factor of minus I. And so you can see tau stays invariant, and under a combination of both of these dualities, the three-form flux stays invariant. So it's fine as a u-duality, but it's non-trivial because it mixes some of the BPS charges up. So it appears in some particular backgrounds there are additional dualities that survive because they mix with dualities from the s-duality group that would, in general, be broken by fixing of the dilaton and axion. Okay. Now, what I've been talking about so far are u-dualities, in a sense, those that leave the background fixed and take the moduli, take you from one point in the moduli space to another. There are also what I'm calling string-like dualities that take you to different but equivalent backgrounds. So, for example, you could find a duality that, you know, rotates the three-form flux, or even one that takes the Hermitian metric to something non-Hermitian, but also changes the three-form in an appropriate way. The final case and the most difficult duality to look at is what's the duality that corresponds to the R radius inversion duality for the n equals 3 theory. And now remember, the magnetic charges are put together in a bound state. And so the mass of a single magnetic monopole would be doubled compared to what it would be in the n equals 4 theory. So under the usual R duality that we talked about, the masses are not exchanged properly between the electric and magnetic BPS states. And in fact, it seems like we need a duality that, in the heterodic theory, that would take a radius to 1 over 2 times the radius for both directions of a square 2 torus. Now, there is such a duality in the heterodic theory, and this was first discussed, to my knowledge, by paper by Witten on compactifications of type 1 without vector structure. But it only exists if you have one half a unit of the NS2 form. So the usual R duality inverts the radius if BMN is 0. And this new R duality inverts the radius, or takes the radius to 1 over 2 times itself, at a half a unit of BMN. So the question is, is this duality really what's going on here? We don't have a definitive answer. If it were, it would seem then that because of the background fluxes, what would correspond to zero value for BMN in the heterotic theory somehow gets shifted over to a half a unit of the beta MN that we defined for the n equals 3 theory. So again, could this type of duality, maybe you'd need to combine it with an SL2Z duality, be the electric magnetic duality for the n equals 3 theory? You know, like I said, we're not really sure. It's possible that there's not even an electric magnetic duality like this. But, you know, there's nothing to rule this out either. So that's, again, something to look at in the future. So just to wrap up, at the moment, I'm working with Mariana on trying to figure out the super multiplets of the strings and the five brains in the appropriate three-form fluxes to just verify that there's the appropriate state counting. It'd be nice to have a more complete understanding of the U and string-string-like dualities for both the n equals 3 and n equals 4 cases. Again, n equals 4 has been considered for the heterotic theory in great detail, but it'd be nice to, you know, just look at it from the 2B perspective. And also, you know, maybe at limits of the moduli space, there's a string-string duality that takes us over to one of the free fermion n equals 3 theories that has been constructed on the string world sheet. And that would be interesting to see. There's no way to know at this point whether that's true or not. One possible hint is that it doesn't seem like we've got the largest possible new duality group in the large radius limit. Maybe in the small radius limit, we'd, you know, pick up more of that duality group, and that may be indicative of something like this. Possibly, if you were to get lucky, you could do a similar analysis for n equals 2 compactifications, but it would be more difficult. So that's something I may end up looking at. And also, I'm hoping to get a more complete understanding of the solutions for the equation of motion. You know, at the very least, one should be able to consider perturbations around the large radius limit. And this would be useful for, you know, looking at modifications of the masses or figuring out, well, what's the coupling of the bulk modes to modes on the brain, things like that. So that may be of more interest to phenomenologists, but I think it's also good to just have a better understanding of the Kaluza-Klein reduction in warp compactification, since it's not completely understood yet. So that's everything I was planning on saying, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Yeah, actually, so you'd naively think that it would just be like I mentioned, the moduli space is this coset of U3, 3 plus n. And so naively, you would just expect that the U dualities are the discrete group of U3, 3 plus n. And it turns out we don't appear to get that full discrete group. Now, one thing that's worth noting is that we are working only in the large radius limit when we're considering the BPS states and the geometry and everything. We don't really have any geometrical understanding of small radii because you get negative warp factors close to the orientifold planes and stuff like that. So what this seems like is analogous to, say, you just took usual compactification of type 2b on a torus or your favorite easy string compactification. If you take some of the radii to be very large and essentially decompactify them, you lose some of the t-duality, so your u-duality group shrinks. And it may be that this is what's going on here. And it seems like it would fit that pattern. And maybe, like I said, it would be interesting to see if you go to other limits of the moduli space, different parts of this larger u-duality group are broken. And that might indicate that there's a duality to another description of the same background.
Any more questions? Well, let's thank Andrew.